Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulubi. This week on Culturetopia, David Foster Wallace's last and most ambitious work will be published later this month. His editor talks about working with an unfinished manuscript. The clever low-tech special effects of Re-Animator, the musical. And the brave new world of kids publishing with books for tablets and smartphones. But first,
in the first days after the catastrophe in Japan, Wikipedia trend spotters noticed a startling spike in people searching for information online about Godzilla. The giant reptile has been a symbol of fear of radiation since 1954 when the movie came out, and Americans are using popular culture now to think about Japan's crisis. NPR's Neda Ulubi reports.
Let's get something clear, says Grady Hendricks. He helps run the New York Asian Film Festival.
The Godzilla movies don't have anything to do with what's going on now.
The idea, says Hendricks, you can infer something about Japan's catastrophe from a movie made over 50 years ago is a little nuts. Still, he says,
movies are where we rehearse our fears.
Grady says the Godzilla films are about radiation, but from 1945, when the U.S. bombed Japan twice.
And specifically, the Godzilla series has to do with what happened in 1954 when the United States detonated a thermonuclear device on the Bikini Atoll and irradiated a Japanese fishing vessel,
killing one crewman and scorching and sickening the rest. Footage of the test survives.
The width of the fireball at this time, about 3 seconds after detonation, was 4 miles.
The U.S. government tried to cover up the Lucky Dragon 5 tragedy. It was the main inspiration for the wave of Japanese mutant monster movies that followed. For all of the radiation the U.S. inflicted on Japan in the 20th century, it's hardly as if Japan has a corner on irradiated monster flicks.
Species appears to be Camponotus ficinus.
An American movie called Them came out the same year as Godzilla. It's about 8-foot-long giant ants.
A fantastic mutation, probably caused by lingering radiation from the first atomic bomb.
Radiation needed a face in the 1950s, and the giant ants in Them and the monster in Godzilla provided that kind of horrible external representation of what these invisible forces could be.
Bill Tsutsui is a professor. He's written a book about Godzilla, and he says people didn't understand radiation in the 1950s. They feared it. So the U.S. government enlisted Disney to assuage those fears.
And here to tell you the story of our friend the atom is the author of our book, Dr. Heinz Haber.
Still, suspicions about radiation seeped into the next decade. They helped launch an entire new genre of horror.
The brain of a ghoul has been activated by the radiation.
The zombies in the 1968 movie Night of the Living Dead were a product of radiation, says Lisa Lynch. She's a professor who studies nuclear culture. She says until the end of the Cold War, our fears about mutation were fears about radiation. Then,
fears of global pandemic started to overshadow fears of radiation. And so all of a sudden you have all these mutation movies, but the mutations are not radiation produced. They're usually mutated viruses.
Like in 28 Days Later or Zombieland. Lynch says nuclear fears went in another direction, first about power plant accidents, like in Silkwood or the China Syndrome. Today, she says, the popular imagination is more concerned with acts of deliberate terrorism.
Hijacking nuclear power plants, stealing equipment from nuclear power plants, stealing fissionable materials, dirty bombs, etc.
That was the plot of the TV show Castle just a few weeks ago.
I've been exposed to high levels of radiation. We need emergency services right away.
But there's also something about this cultural moment that seems to resonate with a more heroic side of radiation, one imbued with mid-century optimism. Broadway's most discussed musical, after all, begins with a radioactive spider bite.
And every heart that bleeds will color your world red.
Just like Spider-Man, one of the summer's most anticipated action movies is based on a Marvel Comics superhero whose powers come from radiation, Captain America.
What do you think?
I think it works.
Hollywood's even finding currency in a movie from Japan. Akira is an anime classic set in a nightmarish post-apocalyptic Tokyo after a nuclear explosion.
Maybe we weren't meant to meddle with that ultimate power.
You mean the power of a god.
Warner Brothers remaking it as a live-action film set in New York. Some of the characters are children, given strange powers by radiation. Unlike Spider-Man or Captain America, they're victims. Grady Hendrix.
When you make a movie, you're able to say, hey, this is something I'm scared of. Let me see what it's like when I visualize it. Does it make me less scared, more scared? Is it reassuring?
Whatever it is, Hendrix says, he hopes Wikipedia searches for Godzilla don't distract us from the real human suffering in Japan. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
It's 8 o'clock at night. You have a stack of dirty dishes in the sink, a pile of paperwork on your desk, and your kids want you to read to them. Guess what? There's an app for that. Okay, not the dishes, but you can download a children's book app to your smartphone or iPad. Enhanced children's e-books include narration, animation, and interactive features. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some kids are getting their very first exposure to books on a digital device.
Michelle Kripalani is deeply invested in Dr. Seuss these days for two reasons. His company, Ocean House Media, has the rights to develop the works of Dr. Seuss as digital books, everything from Green Eggs and Ham to The Cat in the Hat. Kripalani also has a two-year-old daughter, Kentia, who loves Dr. Seuss, especially on her father's iPad.
Boy, she can navigate on that thing. It's incredible. There's something about a child's ability to navigate by touching what they want. And I believe that's the magic here. It's just that the child is able to touch the tree or touch the bird or touch the word that they don't know. And that's really one of the things that just changes everything.
What's that?
The kitty, kitty. Can you touch the cat?
Cat.
Good job.
Meow.
No, Pat.
Kripalani
no.
doesn't consider himself an expert on reading. He began his career as a video game developer. But he says his team was very aware that Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, cared deeply about literacy. So in developing digital versions of books like The Cat in the Hat, they wanted to use the interactive features to help children learn to read.
And as the app is reading the book, the individual words are highlighting. So the child is getting an association between what they're hearing and the actual word that's being spoken at the time. Or they can also touch on any of the pictures, and they get a picture-word association. So if the child taps on cat, for example, the letter C-A-T float up, and the narrator speaks in a clear voice, cat.
With the ebook market so hot right now, a lot of people are eager to get in on the ground floor. Rick Richter left the traditional publishing world to found Ruckus Media, which develops digital versions of well-known kids' books, as well as brand new book apps like A Present for Milo.
What a 2 to 4 year old wants in an app really is to poke and be satisfied and really a very high degree of interactivity. So Milo has 80 different touch points and 125 different animations. And they're randomized, of course, so every time the child enters, it's a different experience.
A Present for Milo begins simply enough with a story about a cat and a mouse.
Who's there, there, there? Milo, that's who! And away they go.
Words appear as the narrator speaks them, and illustrations come alive when touched. A mouse squeaks. A plane flies. A piano plays. Other book apps developed by Ruckus are less interactive, but they might offer other options, substituting a well-known actor's narration with a parent's voice, for example. Richter believes these apps are an entirely new art form.
People ask us, are you creating books? Are you creating games? Are you creating, you know, animations? And the answer is yes. And that's what we set out to do. Books you can play with and games you can read.
But as you might expect, for some, an app will always be just an app.
It's not a book for a number of reasons.
Philip Nell is a professor of English and director of the Children's Literature Program at Kansas State University.
One is that in a traditional reading experience, the reader is in charge. The reader acts on the book. With the interactive ebook, the reader does still act on the book, but the book also acts on, and depending on the adaptation, sometimes against the reader. So I would say that it's not a book. It's maybe a relative of the book, but it's not quite a book.
Nell agrees with Richter that these apps are something entirely different. He says highlighting the words can be helpful to a young reader, but he thinks some of the sound effects and interactive features may interfere with the process of reading.
Reading may be involved, but there's more to it than that, and it's different than that. It's, you know, we don't read a film, we watch a film. We don't read a video game, we play a video game. And I was trying to think, what's the verb to describe what the enhanced ebook experience is like? Is it work? Is it use? Do we play an enhanced ebook?
It's true that some of the bells and whistles in kids' book apps can be distracting, says Elizabeth Bird. She's a librarian at the New York Public Library who's come up with some criteria for evaluating children's book apps. She says it's important that all the artwork and interactive features in an app are well integrated with the story. Obviously, not all apps are equal, says Bird, but the ones that get it right can take a book to a new level.
They allow you to do things that you really couldn't do before. For example, there's a wonderful Peter Rabbit app that's out right now, which sort of turns Peter Rabbit into a virtual pop-up book. And you can go beyond that. I mean, there are apps where you can touch a word, it will pronounce it for you, but it can pronounce it for you in any language. So you could learn a language a second way by using one of these picture book apps.
Bird doesn't believe apps are about to overtake books. She says kids move seamlessly back and forth between traditional print books and digital books all the time. And if a parent wants to use a book app to distract a child, well, Bird doesn't see a problem with that either.
Let's say that I'm in a grocery store and I see a parent handing their phone to their child. Do I want them to hand the child a game like Angry Birds, or do I want them to hand them Freight Train by Donald Cruz in the app form? I would prefer that they hand them the book.
Kids' book apps are so new, says Michelle Cripollani, it's not surprising there are problems still to be resolved. But when he thinks about his daughter, those questions go away.
I just stand back in awe, and I just say, wow, she is just going to be able to absorb so much faster, so much earlier. It's really, really awe-inspiring when you see a, you know, 3 or 4 year old child that really gets it.
And of course, just like a good old-fashioned book, an app works best when a parent and child enjoy it together.
Cynthia, can you touch the puppy?
Pup.
Can you touch the cup?
Cup.
Good job.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The life of Malcolm X was the life's work of Manning Marable. He spent years sifting through diaries, archives, and government documents to produce a seminal work, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Tragically, Marable died in a New York hospital on Friday, just 3 days before the release of his book. The biography comes out tomorrow. Georgetown University professor and public radio host Michael Eric Dyson has read an advanced copy of the biography and joins us in the studio to talk about this. Thanks for being here, Professor.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The reality is we were about ready to be doing interviews, journalists were, with Marable about this book coming up this week. That's no longer going to happen. But I hope you can help us try to understand what he was after. He put a lot of work into this book. I mean, it sounds like this book is going to reveal a lot and a lot of nuance that people might not have really understood.
Well, I think so. I mean, there will be startling revelations factually, but I think the broader picture is that Malcolm X was a deeply and profoundly powerful human being who had flaws, to be sure. But Manning Marable's brilliance is that he's able to illuminate the utter humanity of the man without distracting us with minutiae that will be sensational, while nonetheless focusing brilliantly and courageously on some of the stuff that's not so savory, but getting to a broader point that Malcolm X worked in a culture at a time when things were nearly impossible for self-expression among black people. And Malcolm X took the conversation forward and fought against forces from within his own community as well as outside to make that possible.
And how was Marable seen within the scholarly community?
I think that the unfortunate convergence of his death and his posthumous revelation of Malcolm's life will at least add a gravitas and a sense of forbearance, perhaps, that others will, you know, not pull the trigger so quickly and look at this work. This is an enormously exhaustive biography that will be definitive for a while. He looked at diaries and FBI files and government documents, and he really scoured the entire landscape for every bit of information about Malcolm X, looking beyond the self-mythology of the classic autobiography and the kind of hateful assaults upon him in a broader culture, as well as the adoring hagiography of acolytes. So what Manning Marable provides for us is a powerful work that gives a complex, complicated, colored and colorful, nuanced perspective of a figure and leader. And if people read that, I feel fully confident that they will understand that he loved Malcolm X, he appreciated what he did, and this work is his attempt to try to get things right.
That's Michael Eric Dyson. He's a radio host and a professor of sociology at Georgetown University. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The writer David Foster Wallace struggled with depression for most of his adult life. In 2008, at the age of 46, he took his own life. One of his final acts was to tidy up the manuscript of a novel he'd been working on at the time. The book was supposed to be the follow-up to his 1996 masterwork, Infinite Jest. He'd been working on the book at the time for about 10 years. He called it The Pale King, and later this month, that book will finally be published. But it is not complete. David Foster Wallace never finished it, so his editor at Little Brown, Michael Peach, had to piece it together from the thousands of pages and notes that David Foster Wallace left behind. And Michael Peach joins me now to talk about that process from New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Guy.
Also with us is Wallace's longtime agent, Bonnie Nadel. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
First to you, Michael. By way of explaining briefly what the book is about, I will say that it comes out on April 15th, officially in the bookstores. Can you explain why, Michael?
We chose to publish on April 15th as a way of casting a comic light on a novel that has a lot of darkness surrounding it. And that comic light is that the book is set at the IRS Tax Return Processing Center based in Peoria, Illinois. It centers on the lives and work of a group of IRS tax return processors.
Michael Peach, you are usually used to sort of being in the background, one of the quiet geniuses who makes great writers even better. You did that with David Foster Wallace. First of all, can you describe what he left behind?
What David left behind was nearly 3,000 pages of drafts in various forms. Some of them were handwritten, some of them were neatly typed. Some of them were on computer disks. They were tucked away in various folders. They were spread all through his office. It was this massive material.
Just a pile of things. And in no particular order, just like puzzle pieces.
It was a puzzle piece. Within the book, there were repeated references to a tornadoes, and in notes he'd written to himself, to a tornadic structure that suggested that he wanted this book to be kind of a whirling high wind, massive material coming at the reader that way. So those were some of the guidelines that I followed.
Besides that manuscript, David Foster Wallace left a typed note, and he laid out the premise of The Pale King, and this is what he writes. He says, "Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing, crushing boredom." Michael Peach, what was he getting at here?
The book attempts the greatest challenge I've ever seen a novelist take on, which is to write a novel about the boring parts of life. Every other novelist in history is compressed about around the exciting part.
Right.
Elmore Leonard famously said he became successful when he learned to leave out the parts that people skip. David's goal from the very start was to make people look at the parts they usually skip. There's a chapter written by a character named David Foster Wallace, and he begins by saying, "Go back and read that fine print on the copyright page of the book." His goal was to make people look at the parts of life that they don't usually focus on, and understand that this is where life is really happening.
I mean, he has scenes where he's talking about characters auditing tax returns.
He has characters auditing tax returns. He has characters having long conversations when stuck in an elevator that stopped between floors. He very amusingly sets scenes in these sort of agonizing circumstances, but he makes them riveting. He makes them brilliant. He makes them glorious, and he shows to get outside of ourselves and to actually connect with another person, you have to navigate all the complexity of life, all the difficult, complicated details. By doing that, then you can get to joy and to love and to the meaning of life. So the book deals with boredom, but it's because it wants to deal with joy.
Bonnie Nadel, David Foster Wallace researched this book by taking accounting classes. Can you describe what else went into his preparation?
Well, David was, as well as being an amazing writer, was quite a prodigy at math. And so he could take very advanced accounting classes and follow them. He also started correspondences with various accountants around the country, his own accountant, who did his taxes and his wife's taxes, loved him to pieces because no one ever asks about all the minutiae of doing someone's taxes. And there is a whole section in The Pale King where he has characters talking about the tax code and how the tax code has changed and why it's changed. You remember that part, Michael.
Of course. Also, just to respond further to your question, Guy.
Sure.
The main theme of the book is the complexity and tedium of work. David had written essays about how he wanted to write fiction that really connected with people's true lives. And in this novel, I see him grappling with that. Mm. He's trying to write about what it's like to go home to the same spouse every day for 40, 50 years. How do you look into the face of a job that you know you're going to go and do again for 40 years? How do you do the things that you need to do again and again? How can you find meaning? How can you find delight? How do you find love? How do you find someone who will sit with you while you talk about what happened to you in line waiting to get to the bank teller? David was using this book as a way of trying to write about people and then try to arrive at meaning that connected to people in a really big, deep, heartfelt way.
That's Michael Peach. He was David Foster Wallace's editor at Little Brown and the person who pieced together manuscripts to help create Wallace's forthcoming posthumous novel, The Pale King. We also heard from Bonnie Nadel. She was David Foster Wallace's literary agent. Bonnie, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
The Broadway production of Spider-Man has run into trouble time and time again for its complicated in-your-face effects. Well, a very different kind of in-your-face effect is on display in Los Angeles. Reanimator the Musical, the stage adaptation of the cult movie classic, has just been extended through the end of May. From member station KPBS, Beth Accomando reports on how the show's creators are making sure their audience has a bloody good time.
The first two rows of seats are neatly wrapped in plastic in anticipation of the carnage to come. Welcome to the splash zone of Reanimator the Musical.
So I said, okay, blood is part of the story, and decided that we should have a special zone for the audience who really likes blood to be able to bathe in it, to be showered with it.
That's Stuart Gordon. He directed the cult horror film Reanimator back in 1985. Now he's reassembled the film's visual effects team to find a way to make the blood flow on stage. Tony Dublin says the production goes through 2 to 3 quarts of blood a night.
It also had to be very stylized, you know, because there was no chance to do it over again. You know, you got one shot at it and it has to work.
Both the play and the film are based on an H.P. Lovecraft story about Herbert West, a young med student who discovers a reanimating agent that can bring the dead back to life.
Reanimator! Reanimator! Reanimator!
Doing the stage play now is like doing a low-budget horror film in the 80s, because there was no CGI and no budget for optical effects, so everything was done like you would in live theater, says Gordon.
This is stuff that's the simplest stuff that goes all the way back to ancient Rome. You know, in those days they used to have chicken blood and little bladders and that they could explode on stage.
When you have a practical effect on stage or on screen, it does have a tendency to grab the audience better.
John Beekler is another member of the returning effects team.
The actors have a tendency to react to it more realistically because it's honestly there. And the audience is there in the moment experiencing whatever happens.
Like watching a possessed large intestine fly out to strangle Herbert West. John Nolan collaborated with his wife Shana to create the supple intestines.
She took this flesh-colored material that is actually designed for making the inside lining of swimming suits. And she sculpted it, and it literally moved like a feather boa, weighed almost nothing.
So adding a rubber tube to pump blood meant that it was still easy for actor Graham Skipper to put the prop into action.
We don't have intestines that will actually attack me, so then it's up to me as an actor to pretend that they're attacking me, to time out with the stage manager who's under the stage pumping the blood out, time that with him so that I'm squirting it at different parts of the stage and onto the audience, mostly onto the audience.
Skipper makes it his personal goal to shoot the blood out as far as he possibly can. And that delights people like teenager Gabriela Rodriguez. She came with her drama class from Cesar Chavez High School in Phoenix.
I was sitting fourth seat in, and I like right in front of like the intestine spray at the end, so like I pretty much got splattered. I'm soaked right now. It's a nice feeling.
And that thrills Stuart Gordon, who doesn't want passive patrons in his seats, but rather partners in crime. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
We'll be right back.
dry before they shed. I'm about to lose my head.
Elalea, it's quite a voice, isn't it? And she has quite a story. She was born in Azerbaijan, a Muslim girl in the old Soviet Union who loved jazz, and married a high-ranking Soviet army officer. She sang for a Moscow jazz orchestra, although by law, in those days, she couldn't sing in English. They had a son. A couple of influential Americans heard Elalea sing and helped her and her son Sergei leave the USSR and immigrate to the United States, where she married a rabbi and settled in Chicago. And we'll get to the rest of the story in a while, but first, Elalea has a new CD, Secret Lives of Women, and on it she sings about Anne Boleyn, Cleopatra, Princess Diana, Mata Hari, Sappho, and Sarah Bernhardt, remarkable women, all of whom she says have been a great source of inspiration for a remarkable singer. Elalea joins us from NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Azerbaijan of your childhood.
I always say that it's a magical land, just a magic carpet away. I grew up in the country, Azerbaijan, that was partially Muslim, partially Soviet. So very interesting combination of communism and religion, Muslim religion. Moscow was far enough, so we could probably say that we had more freedom than the rest of the Soviet Union had. Lots of music. For example, mugam, it's a traditional Azerbaijani form of improvisational singing. Mm-hmm. That's what was probably my first influence, musical influence. Then I studied classical music, and then I was introduced to jazz. Initially, I thought that classical music is going to be my life, my future. But hearing jazz, I had to try to do it. And I was, I can say, probably the first girl who played piano and sang jazz in a club in Baku.
Now, I gather that you were a big hit in Moscow, but earned about as much as a bus driver, which is good and honest work, but probably not what you're thinking when you go into show business.
I will tell you the funny story. We recorded an album of children's songs. Mm-hmm. And before even I left the Soviet Union, the number of sold recordings stood somewhere around 3 million. And I earned 15 rubles. I wouldn't even know how to compare it.
15 rubles is not $15 million, but it's probably closer to, what, a dollar or something?
I don't know. But I have to say that, on the other hand, there was something very pure about just being an artist.
You were not discovered by, like, Sir Elton John or Sir Cameron McIntosh, but a couple of influential people, at any rate. If you could tell us the story. You were singing in a jazz club. Well, I'll get you to pick it up.
Yes. I performed in a club that was located across the street from the American Embassy. Mm-hmm. And once I was told that it's Armand Hammer is having his group. Mm-hmm. For his 90th birthday in Moscow.
This is the man often described as billionaire industrialist Armand Hammer.
Yes. He was surrounded with very interesting people, and they asked me to show them Jazz Moscow, and I took them through a few jazz clubs. They were all, of course, underground, and we had a wonderful time. And later, they helped me to come to this country.
You left, let me see if I can put this together. You left your husband, who was the Soviet Army officer.
Yes.
He came to the United States. You married the Rebbe.
Yes.
And you settled in Wilmette, right outside Chicago.
Yes.
And you're living a happy life. And
we started, yes. We started living a beautiful life.
And then your son got sick.
It just happened. Mama, my tummy hurts. That was it.
He was 9?
He was, when he was diagnosed with leukemia, he was 5.5 years old. But he died a few days before his 9th birthday.
I'm so sorry.
You know, it's what, I remember one lady gave me very good advice. She said, you can never overcome, just keep yourself busy. And then I think it's a human nature to grab for any reason to continue on. And for me, it was going back to music.
Thank you for talking to us about that. And we'll talk about this this new CD, Secret Lives of Women.
Yes.
In fact, let's listen to, if we could, Femme Fatale.
She's a mistress of deceit. Before you know, you're at her feet. She steals your money and your heart. She's like a fine work of art, a secret alley of desire that takes you higher, higher, higher.
Song about Mata Hari, huh?
Yep. She's the ultimate archetype of femme fatale, an exotic dancer. It's very interesting because she was, in a way, at the beginning of the 20th century, Hollywood star-like. She was also a courtesan, and she liked to spend time with high-ranking officers on both sides.
So we're talking about World War One.
Yes, World War One. She witnessed a lot of conversations and secrets and everything, and someone just wanted to get rid of her. And she was accused of being a German spy, which there is no evidence whatsoever, but she was shot.
I want to ask you about a song that is very sad for almost everybody still. And this is the song, Irresistible Lies.
I won my sweetest prize. Your irresistible lies. Blue like the morning skies. Your irresistible lies.
You imagine this as a Princess Diana song.
Of course. And she was the one I kind of inspired me to create this work. This beautiful fairy tale that turned into a nightmare of lies and loneliness and then ultimate self-destruction.
You placed me on the throne. A foolish queen's demise. Your irresistible lies.
Is there a part of you that identifies with all of these women?
I think that one thing that unites probably me and reflects on their lives is the very complex lives and a lot of changes that each of my heroines had to go through. In case of Anne Boleyn, it's a rise from a knight's daughter to being crowned as a queen of England, then from the throne of England to the block. In case of Mata Hari, is again coming from nowhere, becoming a star of the stage and then being shot, executed. So working and writing, in a way putting words and giving voice to these women, I wanted also to learn more about myself, to see what's ahead of me.
I'm glad you're doing well.
You know, it's music. You cannot do badly with music.
Ella Leah, her new CD, Secret Lives of Women. It's so nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.